Great speeches and interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We start off with Copenhagen. The capital of Denmark has an ambitious plan to become the world's first carbon-neutral capital by 2025. And then we move on to the mind of a conspiracy theorist. Stephen Lewandowski talks to Chris Mooney about conspiratorial thinking. Conspiratorial thinking clearly plays an important role in science denial on matters ranging from the connection between HIV and AIDS and the safety of vaccines to global warming. And then, after that, does the Canadian government have gag orders for scientists? Canada's Harper administration is allegedly restricting what environmental scientists can share with journalists, according to academics and media watchdogs. Steve Curwood talks with Tyler Sombers, coordinator of Democracy Watch.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. They call it Wonderful Copenhagen, and the Danish city has now determined that on a net basis, it will stop adding climate-changing gases to the atmosphere by 2025. The decision came in an August 2012 city council vote that orders a switch from coal to scrap wood and other sustainable forms of biomass for heat and power. And Copenhagen has also begun to cool its largest buildings using an offshore resource called seawater. Back in 2009, Living on Earth's Bruce Gellerman visited the seawater cooling facility as it was being developed with engineer Jan Hoag.
So now you are in a really, really, this is the heart of the cooling center. This is the inlet from the seawater system. Inside here you have the pipe coming in, and then you have these six pumps circulating the seawater into the cooling center and back to the harbor, a little bit warmer.
Two pipes, each nearly a yard in diameter, buried 20 feet underground, recirculate water 3/4 of a mile from Copenhagen's harbor. Originally built to cool off the old power plant's generators, today the system provides cold water to the new district cooling plant.
If we didn't have these pipes, we didn't have this project, because it would be so expensive for us to put in new pipes in the ground. And although that they're more than 100 years old, they look fantastic. We just have to reline them. And now we use the seawater from the harbor to cool down our chiller units and to the so-called free cooling. And what is free cooling? You produce cold water purely from the water in the harbor.
That's engineer Jan Hoag with reporter Bruce Gellerman. Well, environmental journalist Justin Gerdes dug into Copenhagen's carbon-cutting campaign during a recent fellowship from the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs International Press Initiative and wrote it up for Yale's E360 online magazine. Justin Gerdes reports that the cooling plant is now providing air conditioning at little cost to the environment.
They estimate that doing cooling in this way reduces carbon emissions by nearly 70% and electricity consumption by around 80% compared to conventional air conditioning.
And the cooling is used largely for?
For now, it's largely really big buildings, so ones where more people gather. So it is hotels, office buildings, data centers, And right now it's mostly in the city center, but they're going to be expanding the network in future years. But they don't intend to offer it to residential customers. It's actually a very elegant solution in the sense, too, that they repurpose the same network of underground tunnels that they use for their district heating system. So this is basically sending chilled water to individual buildings via a network of pipes. So not forced air conditioning as we would think of it, typically used in the United States.
Of course, when you come into Copenhagen, you see all those wind turbines out there in the harbor. They seem to have a lot of electricity in Denmark. In fact, they might even have a surplus. How does this figure into their plan?
That is very much in the plans. City officials are basically acknowledging that they won't be able to eliminate carbon emissions entirely within the city boundaries by the timeline, so by the year 2025. And that's largely because of private vehicles. They need more time to convert those vehicles to alternative fuels or electricity. So they're compensating for those emissions by exporting surplus wind from wind turbines located both on and offshore. And they're planning to add around 100 new wind turbines over the next dozen years to do that.
So talk to me about transportation. In reading your article, I noted that you say that Copenhagen is going to build a bike superhighway.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, most Americans, if they've heard anything about Copenhagen, they know it's a bike city. It's one of the world's best bike cities. And, you know, they've been remarkably successful. 36% of trips in Copenhagen to school or to work are made by bike. And for residents of Copenhagen, that number is even larger. It's around half. But they realize that they need to do even more to entice residents and also, more importantly, people commuting in from the suburbs to take bikes. And so they're investing money in building up the bike infrastructure. So they're building these so-called bike superhighways, and the first of them opened in April of last year, and it connects a suburb north of Copenhagen to the city center. Basically, they're very wide, smooth, better-lit bike paths that give these commuters a fast, easy, quick way to get into the city center and try to entice them out of their cars.
How important are efforts by cities to reduce carbon emissions?
The effort to slow climate change is really going to be won or lost in cities. You know, cities are responsible for, you know, around two-thirds of both energy consumption and carbon emissions. So if we can follow the example of some of these, you know, forward-thinking cities like Copenhagen, ones that are already you know, presenting a visionary way forward and can show, you know, best practices, I think you know, other cities, especially in developing countries, can learn from that example, and we can start put a downward trajectory on emissions.
How likely do you think it is that Copenhagen is going to meet this target?
I think it is very likely. Right-of-center politicians in Denmark and Copenhagen are not climate change deniers. They support action on climate change. They only disagree, perhaps, on timelines and how much public money might go toward the effort. So, for example, the carbon neutrality plan that passed in Copenhagen in August of 2012, it did so with the support of right-of-center politicians. Similarly, last year in March, there was a national energy plan that passed in Denmark that's going to get the country off fossil fuels entirely by 2050. And it passed Parliament with the votes of 171 of 179 members, near consensus, which is, you know, pretty unthinkable in the context of today's U.S. political climate.
Justin Gerdes is a freelance environmental journalist. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Our blood runs blue. We're loyal men and true. The hope of a new generation. But we don't speak too well. We can't read or add or spell. California couldn't pay our education. Our rooms each fall were crowded wall to wall, resplendent in squalid privation. And our texts were first rate. Back in 1958, California couldn't pay our education. And 3 years on, when they noticed we were gone, they showered us with consideration. And they transferred our files to the Hall of Juveniles. California couldn't pay our education. They had a great music teacher. But he got laid off. Now we've got great jobs. I stock the salad bar at Bob's. California couldn't pay our education. The proprietor of our local liquor store refused our request for a donation. But we changed his mind with a crowbar from behind. California couldn't pay our education. They locked us away for 3 years and a day, completing our alienation. But we learned from those men how to not get caught again. California finally paid our education.
Coming up next, the mind of a conspiracy theorist.
Welcome to Point of Inquiry. I'm Chris Mooney. Point of Inquiry is the radio show and the podcast of the Center for Inquiry, a think tank advancing reason, science, and secular values in public affairs and at the grassroots. If you don't already, please follow us on Twitter at Point of Inquiry and also on Facebook at /Point of Inquiry. From 9/11 to the death of Osama bin Laden to the Boston bombings, there's been a consistently strange and troubling reaction on the part of some members of the public. I'm referring to the people, a minority, but a surprisingly large one, who always seem to think there's a cover-up. The U.S. government, they feel, was behind the attacks on itself. And as for bin Laden, well, he ain't really dead. These people are called conspiracy theorists, and their particular form of irrationality is uniquely befuddling. It's been often denounced, but more rarely understood, and that's too bad, because conspiratorial thinking clearly plays an important role in science denial on matters ranging from the connection between HIV and AIDS to the safety of vaccines to global warming. Now, fortunately, these conspiracists are now becoming the subject of research and study, and our guest today is helping to lead this inquiry. His name is Stephen Lewandowski. He's a professor at the School of Psychology at the University of Western Australia and at the University of Bristol in the UK, and he's the author of a recent study with the delicious title, NASA Faked the Moon Landings, Therefore Climate Science is a Hoax, An Anatomy of the Motivated Rejection of Science, which drew some small amount of attention, especially when it was followed by a second study of the conspiracy theorists who rejected the first study for conspiratorial reasons. We didn't have to actually talk with Professor Lewandowski by phone in Australia. He happens to be right here in DC in our studio. So, Stephen Lewandowski, welcome to Point of Inquiry.
Oh, Chris, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So, conspiracy theorists, let's talk about who they are and the beliefs they espouse first generally. You define a conspiracy as, quote, the attempt to explain a significant political or social event as a secret plot by powerful individuals or organizations. Does that mean that by definition, all conspiracy theories are irrational?
No, not necessarily, because there are also true conspiracies. For example, Watergate comes to mind, and the Iran-Contra scandal, which was very difficult to invent, I think, or I thought at the time. Reality sort of outpaced my capacity to invent strange things. So the crucial thing for me as a cognitive scientist is to look at conspiratorial thinking not based on what they're trying to explain, but how they do it. The important thing about understanding conspiratorial thinking is the thought process itself. And so one of the characteristics of conspiratorial thinking is that it is self-sealing. That's what we call it. And that means that any evidence to the contrary, any evidence against the conspiracy, is interpreted to be in actual fact evidence for the conspiracy. So basically what happens is that the circle of conspirators is broadened whenever there is evidence to the contrary. And let's just jump straight into climate change, a hugely controversial issue that involves a lot of conspiratorial thinking. Now, you may recall that a couple of years ago, some emails were illegally obtained.
Climategate.
Indeed, Climategate, as it was called at the time. And those emails were spread around the internet, and people interpreted them, cherry-picked them to death, and, you know, created this theory that climate scientists are corrupt and engaged in a conspiracy for God knows what reason. I have no idea why they would do that, but anyhow, that's so the story went. Now, what's interesting is that there have been countless investigations of these scientists. I've lost track. I mean, at least six or
something
seven.
Like six.
Six, yes. Maybe. Yeah, okay. It's a good number. So six in different countries. I think there were three in the UK, another three here in the US. And guess what? They all found that there was absolutely no case to answer. Those scientists did nothing wrong.
So conspiracy.
Hence, it's a conspiracy. But now here's the interesting thing. The interesting thing is that now those investigations are labeled as a whitewash.
Right.
And therefore the conspiracy now broadens from initially just involving climate scientists to now also involving the UK government, the US government, the EPA, any government agency involved in this has now become part of the conspiracy. And that is very typical of conspiratorial thinking. And that, I think, is what is differentiating it from other ways of interpreting the world.
There's some other aspects I've gleaned from some of your papers. It's always a negative secret, not a positive secret. I found that interesting. You pointed out that, you know, no one ever has a conspiracy theory about a birthday party surprise, right? I mean, it's never a good thing.
That's right. Right. Indeed. And that gets us right to the issue of what's the purpose of a conspiracy theory. Why is it that people hold on to conspiracy theories? And that's an interesting question. And I think what is happening there is that people are they have a need to explain bad things. Let's look at something tragic like the Boston bombing or the 9/11 terrorist attacks. I mean, those are horrible, horrifying events. And in a sense, they were completely random. They were unexpected. They came out of nowhere. And that's what makes them incredibly frightening, because the fact that they're unpredictable, random, and boom, all of a sudden they're there. That's scary, isn't it? It's really scary. So how do you deal with that? Well, one way in which people can deal with scary events is to create an explanation that puts some sense into this event. And it turns out there is data to suggest that if you explain something through a conspiracy and by having an enemy, that is actually making you feel better. It is actually giving you a sense of control as a person. That if you can explain an unexpected event through a malicious enemy that's out to get you, that sounds terrible, but in actual fact, it gives people a sense of control, makes them feel better.
So this leads to the question that I think I was thinking as I read your papers a lot, which is there something unique about conspiratorial thinking, or is it just part of a person's array of responses to situations? In other words, is there something about this particular way of thinking that's a syndrome, or that a certain kind of person does all the time? Or is it just, you know, you face uncertainty, you need an answer, or you face, let's call it an assault on ideology, you need an answer, you need to know why the other people are wrong, and so you just, your mind just spins things out. Which one is it?
Well, I think it's a mixture of both, I would be inclined to say. There is some evidence that conspiratorial thinking is usually fairly widespread, that if a person believes in one conspiracy theory, they're likely to believe in others as well. There is a statistical association. So people who think that MI5 killed Princess Diana, they probably also think that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't act by himself when he killed JFK, but that
they're more likely than just the average population.
Exactly, exactly. So there is a statistical association. People tend to cluster in such a manner that if they endorse one theory, they tend to also endorse others. And that association is actually fairly strong. So I think to some extent there is a cognitive style there. That's what I would call it. I think it is just a way of looking at the world by having the style of thinking that invokes conspiracies very readily. So there are clearly people who fall within that cluster of thinking on the one hand. So on the other hand, however, I think it is also situation specific. And let's talk about science a little bit, because the reason I got interested in conspiratorial thinking is only because I'm a scientist and I'm passionate about being a scientist, because I happen to think that that is probably the best way humans have discovered to date to understand the world around them.
We share that view on this show.
I'm sure you do. And so I was fascinated by the fact that there are so many people out there who reject scientific findings that they don't like for other reasons. Now, turns out that if you look at that, if you look at science denial, you find that there's almost invariably a conspiratorial streak to that rejection. So let me give you a few examples. People who reject the link between HIV and AIDS very often think that the U.S. government created AIDS, God knows why. You know, there's a number of hypotheses that these people advance, but there's always a conspiratorial element in there. People who reject vaccinations in particular are often very aggressive in their rejection and resorting to conspiracies.
They think the government is involved somewhere, or Big Pharma is involved.
Big Pharma, yeah. Government, okay. Indeed. So, and then finally, if you look at climate science, I think there it is perhaps more obvious than anywhere else. For example, we have a sitting U.S. senator from Oklahoma. And
Senator Inhofe.
Indeed, indeed. And I should add that I was at the University of Oklahoma for 5 years in the 1990s. Oh, okay. So I have some association with Oklahoma, although I've never met Senator Inhofe. Now, he wrote a book last year called The Greatest Hoax: How the Global Warming Conspiracy Threatens Your Future.
Well, that puts it right front and center.
Yeah. It does, doesn't yes. it? I mean, you know, he's saying, hey, hello, global warming is a hoax. It's a conspiracy by scientists. Now, he's actually written a book with that title.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what else do you need in a sense?
It's a catchy title.
It's a catchy title. It's right out there. He's accusing scientists of conspiring for God knows what reason. I still haven't understood what we're supposed to be doing and why we're doing it.
See a land young and lovely, hard and strong. For 15,000 years we've danced your praises, prayed our thanks, and we've just begun. This is my walks the high country, giving free wild samples and setting an example how to give. Yes, this is my country, retching and turning like a baby burning how to live. From her, and I'm learning how to count upon her.
tall trees and the corn is high country. Yes, I love her, and I'm learning how to take care of her. When the new stories get me down, I take a drink of freedom to think of my America from total crown. It's never long before I know just why I belong here. Ooh, soldier blue, soldier blue. Can't you see that there's another way to love her? Soldier blue, can't you see that there's another way to love? Soldier blue, soldier blue, can't you see that there's another way to love?
And now for something completely different.